as time goes by and a generational thing that just becomes accepted as fact when more than likely it may not be.
Yeah, that really is the nature of history, is most of what's accepted as being fact never happened.
Yeah. So the spear ends up in Antarctica and possibly...
Actually, when I started telling you the story, I said, I think it's a hoax. I think Colonel Buchner was the victim of an incredibly elaborate hoax. I don't think it's credible that this happened. However, it is now a part of the spear legend. You know, our book is Secrets of the Holy Lands, the Spear of Destiny in History and Legend.
Yeah.
What we try to do is we try to get every piece of the spear legend, regardless of how idiotic it is. I mean, we included the stuff about it being made by Tubal Cain. You know, we don't think it was made by Tubal Cain. We don't think Tubal Cain ever existed. But it's a part of the legend. And so what we did is we tried to assemble the entire spear legend and then link it to what historical facts we can to flesh out whether or not it is or isn't true. We make it quite clear that from Dr. Feather's work, it's improbable that the spear in Vienna was the spear that was used in the crucifixion. In fact, we make it quite clear that it's improbable that any of the spears were used in the crucifixion. If the one that has the greatest likelihood of being it is the one in the Vatican, and the Catholic Church is saying, well, we don't know. Well, if they're not making any claims, it probably isn't it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if they really did have it, they would be screaming, we got it.
Oh, exactly, yeah. So do you think that speaks to the idea that maybe it's the idea of the Holy Lance, that it's like if you believe that it's the Holy Lance, it gives you a false sense of unstoppableness. I don't know, I'm in a lot
right.
of words.
Right, invincibility.
Yes.
I believe that Hitler believed that he had the spear of destiny, and that he believed that with it he was invincible. And for a couple of years there he was. The belief in the object is really the object.
Yeah.
You know, and there are one of the things we tackled in the book was these bizarre supernatural stories around it. And one of the areas, I'm not really sure whether I managed to get this into the book or not. Since you just read the book, maybe you can help me out by saying whether you read it in there.
Yeah.
One of the things is I was thinking as I'm writing it is, this thing is on display. It's on public display for 1,200 years.
Mm-hmm.
It is believed by most of people looking at it that it is magical, that it has powers.
Yeah.
Now, how much power does a human being have? Are we just meat or are we spirit? Is there mind over matter? Can the mind change matter? Can the mind have an effect on matter? If a million people looked at an object and thought it had magic, would that give it magic?
Yeah, that's an interesting idea, yeah.
You know, even if it is a hoax upon a hoax upon a hoax,
yeah.
It still might do what it says it does.
Exactly, yeah. Because like you said, if it's been on display for 1,200 years, you know, it sort of builds upon itself.
Exactly.
The belief, almost like how money is really paper, but it's worth something to everybody because they believe it's worth something.
Right, you know, the Federal Reserve notes are just dirty pieces of paper.
Exactly.
But everybody wants some.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Now, the Holy Lance of Hitler ends up in, other than, like, well, the Holy Lance of Hitler ends up in back in Vienna where it had been before he got it. Do you ever see a situation where the Lance, as, like, throughout human history, various folks have had the Lance, or claimed to have the Lance, and been these powerful leaders, and now we're living in modern times. Do you expect to see a time in the future, can you envision that? Is someone's going to want that lance, or someone's going to show up claiming to have the other, like the real lance, you know, type of situation?
You know,
or is it destined to become just a museum relic?
The materialist modernist in me says it's just a museum relic. However, as we began this conversation, we know that at least 85% of Americans believe in angels.
Yeah.
You know, if there are people, you know, we know that 95% of Americans believe in the God of the Bible. This means that somebody can play on that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Somebody can use that belief. Even and particularly if they possess that belief. You know, that again, belief is the most powerful thing in human history. You know, humans have been busy whacking each other since the beginning of history over questions like whether or not God wears trousers.
Exactly. And like, well, how long was it in the museum before Hitler got it in the first place? 200 years?
It was in Vienna. Okay, it was spirited out of Nuremberg at the end of the 1700s, like 1798.
Oh, okay.
The Holy Roman Empire collapsed in 1806. And it was sold to the Habsburgs after that, so it's probably been in the Habsburg Museum. And we didn't get a date on when it was actually installed, but we think it would have been around 1807, plus or minus a year.
Yeah. So like that goes to what I was going to say is that like it was on display there for like 150 years, and I'm sure at the beginning.
And then 400 years in Nuremberg before that.
Yep.
Charlemagne had it on display. Most of the people who have had it on display.
Yeah.
So Charlemagne, in the year 800, has it on display in his castle in Aachen, and puts it on coins, and uses it ceremonially. And many of the possessors of it had used it ceremonially. So there would be, you know, rallies with, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that would see this thing in a single moment.
Yeah. And it was on display for so long, and it kind of speaks to the idea that maybe back in when World War II was before it started and everything, it probably would have never dawned on people, much like it wouldn't dawn on people today, that some crazy nut is going to want to get that Holy Lance because he thinks it's going to help him rule the world. So it's entirely possible that, you know, in 100 years from now, war could break out in Europe again, and some crazy bastard is going to be like, I need that Lance. And, you know, they'll be talking about it on the 24-hour news.
Yeah, it's very possible. It's very possible. And then again, it's not impossible that the Buchner scenario has some truth in it. It is quite that we have established that there was the Führer convoy. At least three super subs went to Argentina and possibly Antarctica. It's not impossible. You know, there were very strong ties between Germany and Japan during the war. It's not impossible that a Japanese swordsmaker could have fabricated a replica that would have been good enough to have fooled the people in Vienna. It's unbloody likely, but it's not impossible.
Yeah.
And if all of that is true, if it really did go to Antarctica and was rescued in 1979, it's a player on the world stage now. It is in a claimant's hands. It is being used by somebody for some purpose at this moment in time. It's not just in a museum or in a church in Armenia.
Exactly, yeah. So that there's also that entire possibility that, like as you allude to, as the Fourth Reich, and sort of the groundwork was laid with Project Paperclip and the CIA being formed at NASA, that the whole Nazi element may have gone underground, including the Holy Lance.
Right, and there's an awful lot of evidence about the Nazi underground. It's one of the one of the books I helped Jim Keith with was his very first book. As I said at the beginning, Jim and I were publishing a magazine called Dharma Combat, and we got wonderful stuff for Dharma Combat, and we decided, Jim decided that he wanted to go from it being a zine to being a real magazine. In fact, what he wanted to do is he wanted to bring it out in paperback form as a quarterly paperback.
Yeah.
And he got a hold of Adam Parfrey at Farrell House, who just had a huge success with his Apocalypse Culture. And Adam didn't want to do it as a periodical. He wanted to do it as a book. And so we pulled together some great stuff from Dharma Combat, and Adam had a few things in his files that he hadn't really found a home for. And we put them together as the book Secret and Suppressed, Banned Ideas in Hidden History. And one of the articles in it is an interview with a guy who claimed to have been basically the inspector general for a mafia-like organization of ex-Nazis that had been run by Otto Scorsese, who was Hitler's favorite commando. To the Nazis, he was what our Rambo is. He was viewed as being the greatest soldier alive, and was used by Hitler as an example of what a great soldier should be, and he was hugely popular, and apparently his death was faked, and he went to Spain and operated what he called the Nazi International, which was theoretically a business venture, but was in fact a mafia-like operation that ensured business went to former Nazis who were Nazis who had escaped to various points all over the world.
Now, do you think, just from your own perspective, that should some shadowy organization have the Lance now, do they need to let it be known that they do, or can they just use it for their own devious pursuits? Because obviously there's a lot of talk of conspiracy theory nowadays, and especially in this post-9/11 world and New World Order talk. Let's say the New World Order's got the Lance. Do they have to let us know that they have it, or do you think they could just use it to take over the world? Just your thoughts on it. You know, obviously, like, it's not going to be written in Time magazine or something.
Yeah, I doubt if the people who have the Lance today, if it's not the one in Vienna, if it is hidden somewhere in the world, it's hidden for a reason, and they would only bring it out if it had propaganda value to bring it out.
Yeah, it's not like they have it and they're going about their plans to take over the world. And
well, we examine this question at the end of the book. We try to make some guesses as to where the Lance is now, and George came up with a pretty good guess. So that's what went in the book. Is Kurt Waldheim was the former Prime Minister of Austria and former Secretary General of the United Nations,
mm-hmm.
and he was elevated to the position of Secretary General of the United Nations shortly after the Lance was rescued from Antarctica. So that may have played a role, and if it went to him, that may be why he was elevated to, you know, king of the world there for a minute.
Yeah.
I think it's hilarious that he lives in Vienna, a few blocks from the Royal Palace where the spear is on display. So the spear may actually live a few blocks from itself.
Exactly. In the introduction, you talk a lot about Jim Keith. I didn't realize, obviously I didn't realize this until I read the introduction, that you knew him since high school. And like you were telling these stories about you guys were teenagers working on this stuff. What was that like growing up with Jim Keith? Because he's a pretty well-known name in the esoteric community and a very well-known conspiracy writer. Obviously he passed away, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about that. But you sound like you were really good friends with the guy, so tell me about Jim Keith so we can keep his memory alive.
Yeah, Jim was my best friend from 1966 to 1999. One day in about the third or fourth day of the school year, I'm in PE class, and I hear these two guys talking about Lord of the Rings, and I just finished reading it. And I walked over and butted into their conversation. And it turned out they had they were members of a local science fiction club, in fact, founders of the local science fiction club, and invited me to join. This was the Valley Science Fiction Association, the VALSA. And I ended up hanging out with them practically every day of my life throughout my, from 16 to 22. We did, Jim and I did a number of scenes together. Jim had a rather broad swath. Jim was very tall, very handsome, blonde-haired, blue-eyed Aryan. He was a poet, very emotional fellow, and had women lined up to be his girlfriends. I mean, he had an entourage of women hanging off of him. Of course, I was always very jealous of that.
I'm jealous of it just here.
Yeah. And every time I got a girlfriend, she ended up with him.
Oh, man.
and then got passed on.
Oh, jeez. And were you guys, like you say, you guys were interested in sci-fi, and then it sort of just grew into the esoteric research that you guys became well-known for, right?
Well, you know, a lot of things going on there. I had, I'm remembering these strange things. 1966, or 67, I'd known Jim for, I don't know, 6 months or so, and Jim had heard about the I Ching, and his library card, he was not very good at taking library books back, owed a mountain of fines, so he asked me to go to the library and check it out for him.
Yeah.
And we both really got into the I Ching, and Eastern religions in a variety of ways. We were always, we were heads. We were part of the psychedelic 60s.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's a lot of, I was very taken with Zen Buddhism and the Tao Te Ching and so on. I actually, the early 70s, I ran for county commissioner on a Taoist ticket.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So Jim and I, from high school on, were very much interested in the esoteric, not so much conspiracy, but alternative religions. In one of the zines we were doing, which was, oddly enough, we never did figure out a title for it, so it was simply untitled. It got huge critical acclaim. It was generally reviewed as the best zine of that year,
awesome.
Out of L.A.
Oh, wow.
And one of the articles we published was something, in science fiction fandom has a lot of connections to Scientology. L. Ron Hubbard was a science fiction writer and a member of the LOSFUS, which we were also members of the LOSFUS. The LOSFUS, the Los Angeles Science Fantasy Society, the oldest science fiction club in the country. It's met every Thursday night since 1936.
Oh, wow.
Has a clubhouse in North Hollywood right now. And so I knew a lot of people who knew L. Ron Hubbard, and I knew a lot of people who had been in and out of Dianetics and Scientology. Jim and I were doing this untitled scene, and we got an article from an old-time Dianeticist, or before it was Scientology, it was Dianetics.
Yeah.
And this guy gave us an article with the title Nonfiction, and it was recalls from the last 3 billion years of his past lives, and the Dianetic techniques used to help him remember them.
Yeah.
And Jim just flipped over this. Shortly after that, we ended up splitting up. We were in Pomona, California, and his parents moved to Kansas City, and neither of us had jobs. We're both in our early 20s. Neither of us have jobs. We're mooching off our parents. He goes to Kansas City with his parents. Meanwhile, another member of the crew, Jim Schumacher, and his girlfriend decide they're going to get out of L.A. And I end up moving with them to Klamath Falls, Oregon. And I don't see Jim for a couple of years. And then he shows up on my doorstep one day, and again, he's very emotional. He's crying. He's crying continuously because his love affair just went south on him. And it turns out that he had worked for the Church of Scientology in Kansas City, where he had learned that if you work for the church, you get free training and counseling. So he had signed up for the free stuff and was working for them, and then had gone to Riverside, California, and worked for the church there.
Yeah.
And that's when he fell in love with this girl, and then she broke his heart, and he didn't know what to do, so he came and mooched off me. This was summer of 75. No, I take that back. He showed up just before Thanksgiving 74.
Okay.
I'm working as a busboy, and I'm sick of working as a busboy. I throw in the towel on that, and I don't have a job. He doesn't have a job. Summer 75, I go down to San Francisco. Now, he's having me read. He's telling me, every day he's telling me how wonderful Scientology is and all the wins and gains he's got and how perfect the tech is and yada, yada.
Yeah.
So I go down to San Francisco, summer of 75, and to attend a science fiction convention, and I'm staying at a friend's house, and he's one of the Valsa crew who had left Pomona and moved to San Francisco. He's living in Noe Valley, if you know where that is, which is a little off from the Hay, and I'm staying on his couch, and I decide before going back to Klamath Falls to just check out Scientology, see what it looks like.
Yeah.
Somehow I ended up becoming a staff member and worked at the Church of Scientology San Francisco for 3 months, which annoyed my friend because I'm camped out on his couch.
Yeah, yeah.
That came to an end, and I went back to Klamath Falls, and by this time I'm a true believer. Jim's a true believer. And I'm in Klamath Falls for a couple of months, and we did another zine together called Skyline Klamath Falls. And one night during a blizzard, snowstorm, we're waiting for our printer to show up. He never shows up. And I say, well, you know, I've had enough of this. And I joined the monastic order of Scientology called the Sea Org. And a couple of days later, I'm back. I'm in L.A. wearing a mock naval outfit and working in a Scientology facility. Jim stayed in Klamath Falls for a number of years, and then he went down to Reno to visit his parents, and while he's there, his father had a heart attack, gets a triple bypass, and never really quite recovers from it. And Jim finds himself now living in Reno as babysitting his father.
Yeah.
I escaped from Scientology and I'm back at my parents' house, which, you know, every day is, oh, I gotta get out of here.
Yeah.
I work for a couple of years as a travel agent, and then I'm using all my free travel benefits to go up to Reno to go over writing projects with Jim, because we're now really serious about becoming writers.
Yeah.
This is the mid 80s, and we have, you know, pissed away a decade on Scientology.
Yeah.
and bad love affairs, and finally I decided, you know, I'm wasting my travel benefits, I'll just move there, and I moved to Reno just about 20 years ago, and Jim and I really tried hard to be fiction writers, and we cranked out a great deal of fiction. Some of it sold, most of it didn't. I got into this ghostwriting gig and did a lot of ghostwriting that didn't make much money or get me any press, and that was sort of depressing. And then we did Dharma Combat, and that got got us into a very unusual scene. We discovered the Patriot Movement, and there was a number of people out there who realized that there was a coming world government, and it was not going to be pretty.
Yeah.
And so we end up working with those folks, and there's also this whole, the New Age is getting weirder by the day.
Exactly, yeah.
And we're publishing a New Age magazine in which we're going, you know, this stuff is not good.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of where we were. And then, as I said, Jim's first book was Secret and Suppressed, which grew out of Dharma Combat. His second book also, we had published something in Dharma Combat called the Skeleton Key to the Gemstone File. And this is wild, wild stuff. It's been circulating samizdat for 20 years or more before we published it. Apparently, the story is, there was a guy named Bruce Roberts who was a scientist, and he developed the technology for making artificial rubies, which are necessary for lasers and a number of other things.
Yeah.
And he takes his technology for making artificial rubies to Howard Hughes.
Mm-hmm.
And Howard Hughes stole it.
Oh,
this really pissed off Bruce Roberts. So he then starts making artificial rubies and selling them as real ones. And using that to raise money to find stuff about Howard Hughes. He writes his mom like daily letters of what he finds. So eventually he ends up with like 1,000 letters.
Yeah.
That are all the stuff he's found. And there's a woman on the California coast who's been looking into the JFK hit and the Nazi connections to it, and doing a little radio show called Conspiracy Corner named Mae Brussel.
Mm-hmm.
And Mae Brussel is like the queen of conspiracy.
Yeah.
And he shows up with these 1,000 letters that what he's found is that Howard Hughes was kidnapped and murdered by Aristotle Onassis, who was the guy who actioned, who paid for the JFK hit. The day he shows up at Mae Brussel place, it just happened that there was a reporter from Playgirl magazine named Stephanie Caruana visiting and interviewing Mae at the time. She offers to read the 1,000 letters and put them in and make a digest of what's in them.
Yeah.
So this becomes known as the his letters are the gemstone file.
Mm-hmm.
And so her digest of it, her abstract of it, is the skeleton key to the gemstone file.
Yeah.
So we published this in Dharma Combat, and it turns out there's this guy named Ron Bonds who has been collecting every known copy of it. And he gets in contact with Jim Keith. They bounce some ideas off of each other, and they decide to produce a book. Ron creates a publishing company, which he calls Illuminet, and Jim writes the first book for Illuminet, which is The Gemstone File, which is, Jim doesn't really write the book so much as edit it. It's a collection of, it's an anthology of articles written around either supporting or trashing The Gemstone File. And he comes in contact with a lot of the key movers and shakers in the conspiracy movement. Ron Bonds creates holds a convention in he lives in the Atlanta area, and he holds a science fiction goth conspiracy convention.
Yeah.
And apparently it was what really made Jim's career, going there and meeting in the flesh some of the major shakers in the movement.
Yeah.
And out of that came his career. And I to this day I kick myself for not having gone.
I bet. And you stayed close to him up until his untimely death. Well, that must have been quite a shock, because it was a surprise. It wasn't really like, it was an accidental, I wouldn't even say accident, it was sort of like a fluke Yeah, right.
Yeah, it was very odd. My co-author on Secrets of the Holy Lance is George Picard,
yeah.
whose previous book was Liquid Conspiracy, and George and Jim went to Burning Man together. Burning Man is the world's greatest art festival.
Yes.
It's held for a full 8 days in the Nevada desert, about 120 miles north of Reno, in a place called the Black Rock Desert.
Mm-hmm.
And there were probably about 28,000 people there the year that Jim and George went. And that was George's second time to go, and Jim's first. And at Burning Man, it's not like a rock concert. It's not one big stage and everybody sits looking at it. It is a full-on city. It is the seventh largest city in the state, with hundreds of miles of streets and major art installations and major art events taking place continuously. At any given year, there are 100 or 200 stages.
Oh, wow.
But They were on a stage that was set up for a band who called themselves the Black Rock Rangers. And at some point in the middle of the night, around 1, 2 in the morning, they realized that they were the only people sitting on the stage, that everybody had gotten off and left them there, and they'd been so busy talking to each other they hadn't noticed it. So they decided, well, you know, let's go somewhere where there's some action. And George jumped down and took a couple of steps and then turned to say something to Jim and realized that Jim wasn't there. And he looked back and Jim is in a pile at the foot of the stage. And it had only been about 3 or 4 feet high. And Jim was a very large guy. He was like 6'4", 6'6".
Oh, wow.
He wasn't fat, but he was overweight. I would guess he was pushing 300 pounds, probably 280, 290, something like that.
So he was stocky.
Yeah, he was. His calves were bigger than my head.
Oh, wow!
And he went down hard. I mean, they'd been drinking all day for a couple of days, and he didn't know his own strength. Went down, and they couldn't tell what had happened exactly. And they went to the medical tent, and the guys at the med tent couldn't tell whether it was broken or sprained. And Jim is just, you know, it's nothing. I'll get over it.
Mm-hmm.
And so George takes Jim home, and so it's, you know, it's a 3-4 hour drive back, and they get in about sunrise, and it took Jim 45 minutes to crawl from the car to his living room.
Oh, Jesus.
Now, this is, I think, Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Jim was the sort of person who simply refused to fix anything.
Yeah.
When he died, he lived in a mobile home. Neither of the doors actually closed. A third of the windows were broken out. The shelves in the kitchen didn't hold anything because they'd all collapsed. You know, I mean, yeah. the Jim simply refused to fix anything. If it broke, he just left it. So he broke himself, and he refused to fix it. He had two daughters. I believe they were 11 and 13 at the time, and he ordered them not to call the hospital, not to call the ambulance, that he'll get over it. Well, the girls didn't know what to do, so they called Jim's sister, Aunt Kathy.
Yeah.
And so Aunt Kathy drives down from Portland.
Oh,
she gets there about Tuesday, takes one look at him and says, "You're going to the hospital, buddy." Because he hadn't moved off the floor for 2 days.
Yeah.
So they get him into an ambulance, and but he gets to the hospital either Tuesday or Wednesday, I forget which. He gets there, and yeah, it must have been Wednesday he gets to the hospital. He gets there, and of course, having not moved, with a broken leg, his blood chemistry is shot, and they got to stabilize him. So they keep him overnight, and the last non-medical person to see him alive saw him about 2 o'clock Thursday afternoon, and she said that when she came into his room, there were two massage therapists giving him physical therapy.
Yeah.
Now, he goes into the OR, and apparently he makes it out of the OR, goes into ICU, and dies from a blood clot to the lung.
Yeah.
Now, that physical therapy ensured that if there were any blood clots, they would get loose and go somewhere nasty. So I put his death down to, at the least, medical malpractice.
Yeah, yeah. So you think, you're not like a big subscriber to the he was murdered type of thing. You think it was just probably by like just a lousy medical work?
Yeah, that hospital is infamous for lousy medical work.
Oh, really?
Here's a good example of this is you is Jason May. You may know Jason May. He acquired the RFK archive from the LAPD after when Robert Kennedy was shot at the Ambassador Hotel. The LAPD collected this immense amount of evidence, like there was like 10,000 documents in the LAPD file, and Jason May got it. So Jason May is a friend of Jim's and a friend of Jim's lawyer. Jim's lawyer for a short while was also Sirhan's lawyer.
Oh wow.
It's pretty clear that Sirhan was a mind control victim, and that he was not the shooter. In fact, he apparently had a starter's gun firing blanks. And was clearly in a hypnotic state. He was clearly not in possession of his own mind during the event.
Yeah.
So Jason May, 2 weeks after Jim dies in Washoe Medical Center, checks into Washoe Medical Center to get some elective surgery. And he's lying there in the bed, and the orderlies come in and they start prepping him for the surgery, but they're prepping the wrong side of his body. He demands to know what's going on. Well, he just happens to look at the wrist tag. You know, when you go to the hospital, they put a tag around your wrist to identify who you are.
Yeah.
He looks at it, and it says he's Edna May.
Huh.
They're prepping him for some woman's surgery. At that point, he realized, Jim just died here a couple weeks ago. They're going to do the same thing to me. He got up, put his clothes on, and walked out of the hospital.
Yeah. So it's a pretty lousy hospital.
Yeah, I've gone there a few times, but never willingly.
There you go. All right. And obviously it was a big loss to lose Jim Keith in the esoteric community because he was a very good researcher and author and everything. So, I'm really sorry to hear about that. And I didn't get into the field really until after he had passed. So it's too bad for me because I never got a chance really to find out more about him and meet him as I'm meeting so many other people now in the field.
One of the great losses is that he insisted that he had figured out the secret to Baphomet. The Templar code word that everybody's been trying to figure out what the heck it means for the last 1,200 years.
Yeah.
He was convinced that he had figured it out, and he wouldn't tell anybody because he was going to write a book on it.
Oh man, and he took that to the grave with him.
Yeah.
He never gave you any clues?
Mm-mm. every time I asked him about it, he'd say things like, that would be telling.
Now, did you and him grow up in L.A.? Because you said you guys ended up there. Did you guys grow up in L.A., or where did you guys go to high school?
It was Pomona.
Okay.
Pomona is about 40 miles due east of downtown Los Angeles.
Nice.
I believe he was born in Kansas City. I was born in Pomona shortly after birth. I was moved out of town. My parents, I'm adopted, and the papers were signed on me 3 days before I was born. And as soon as I was ready to leave the hospital, my parents took me to where they lived, which was in Paris, California, Perris. And I lived in Paris for the first 5 years, and then sort of drifted around in Southern California, and oddly enough, ended up back in Pomona for high school.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and that's where you met Jim Keith.
That's where I met Jim Keith, who had, he had grown, most of his grade school years were spent in the Silver Lake District in downtown L.A.
Oh, okay.
And
then
for junior high, he moved out to Pomona where he met Jim Schumacher and Russell Brian Brooker. And we're all still friends. I talk to both of those guys at least once a month. And we have a little online club and two discussion groups because the one part of the club is feuding with the other, which is which is how it's always been. I mean, the Valsa always was one part of the club feuding with the other, and the feud never went away, but just who was feuding with who changed.
That sounds like much of the esoteric community in general, always feuding.
Yeah.
Well, wow, what's next for you now that the Lance book has been out? What can we expect from you in the future?
Well, I'm working on chemtrails, HARP, and weather warfare, the military's plan to draft Mother Nature.
Yeah.
And while I'm working on it, I have a pretty sweet deal from my publisher. My publisher owns most of the town of Kempton, Illinois. He, as well as his house, he owns several other houses, and two houses are open as guest houses. One is the World Explorers Club clubhouse, and the other is the Knight's Armory Bed and Breakfast. And I'm staying in the Knight's Armory Bed and Breakfast. So I'm living rent-free while I'm writing the book, but I'm working at the bookstore. The Adventures Unlimited Press has a bookstore and fulfillment center and warehouse here in town. Also has a bar and grill. So I spend 6 or 8 hours a day answering phones and picking orders, and then I spend a couple hours a day writing the book.
Oh, that's nice. That's a good deal. Now, when do you expect that book will be rolling out? Sometime this year, next year, you think?
We are holding a conference here on May 6th, and my plan is to hand the final manuscript to the publisher on May 5th. So I'm going to give him the manuscript, and then I'm going to speak at the conference, and then I'm going to pack my bags.
Nice. What information do you have about that conference? Because I haven't heard anything about it. That might be something worth checking out.
Well, it's May 6th. Actually, that's when the talking is going to be. It's going to be a 3-day gala, May 5, 6, and 7. Friday the 5th, we're going to have wine and cheese reception and all night drinking. And then Saturday, we'll have a number of speakers that will include David Hector Childress speaking on Mu, Atlantis, and Power Systems of the Gods. Mm-hmm. Christopher Dunn, who wrote the Giza Power Plant, where he has made the great breakthrough in Egyptology. He has conclusively proven that the Great Pyramid is not a burial mound, but was in fact a machine. And so his topic is going to be evidence of ancient machining. A number of other speakers are going to be like William Henry,
yep.
Speaking on Cloak of the Illuminati, and myself speaking on Secrets of the Holy Lands. All in all, I think there's 7 speakers.
Awesome.
And it'll go late into the evening, and we'll have a banquet. And then Sunday is sort of your basic dead dog party of people hanging out and getting autographs and, you know, recovering from the hangovers.
Yeah, and networking and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, awesome.
And again, that's in Kempton, Illinois. Kempton is about a 2-hour drive south of Chicago's O'Hare Airport, about halfway between Chicago and Champaign, and it's just about dead center between I-55 and I-57.
Okay, now, is there a web address for that, or could they do a Google search for the name of the conference, or what's the best way to find information? Well, through your website, you think?
Yeah, it's on the World Explorers Club website, which is www.wexclub.com.
Okay, and let's give out your websites here. It's jerryesmith.com. And that's JerryeSmith.com, SMITH. And for information about the book, it's spearbook.com, correct?
That is correct. Spearbook it's got some technical name, but it's not really a website, but it'll bounce you over to the website, because the real name for the website is secretsoftheholylands.com, and that's just the front page. And then to go to the main page, it's, you know, secretsoftheholylands.com/squiggle things and weird, you know, equals page one, you know, nonsense. Nobody can remember that. I can't remember that. So just spearbook.com. You don't even need the darn W's. Just spearbook.com, and it'll take you there.
Awesome. And that's SPEARBOOK.com. And if you want to just pick up the book, if you want to just call the number is 1-800-718-4514, and that's the Adventures Unlimited press order line. Yeah, right?
Righto. 1-800-718-4514. Call during normal business hours, and Beth and Mary will be happy to take your order.
Yes, and tell them you heard the interview on Banal America Audio.
Now, to get an autograph copy, go to Spearbook. At spearbook.com, you can get a copy autographed by both the authors. To get a, if you call Beth or Mary at Adventures Unlimited Press at 1-800-718-4514, if you tell them you want an autograph copy, I will autograph one to you. But it won't have George's autograph. You got to go to spearbook.com to get George's autograph.
Okay.
Or you can just go to amazon.com, or you can go to barnesandnoble.com, or you can go to your local Barnes & Noble. It's in all major bookstores.
Awesome.
And you can get it at amazon.com for a discount, but no autographs.
Okay. And once again, we'll give the number out again one time, 800-718-4514, and call during business hours. Don't call at 2 in the morning. Cause,
well, you can, but you'll get an answering machine. And I know most people are a little queasy about leaving their credit card numbers on an answering machine.
Yeah, exactly. So call during business lines. So you can order the book. Check out the book. I really enjoyed it. It's awesome. It covers the Holy Lance all through history, where it's turned up, who's claimed to have it, who's had it, and all the various adventures they've had with the Lance. And then also, really in-depth, Hitler and his role with the Lance, and what may have happened to the Lance after that. A lot of great stuff on the Antarctic, rumors of Nazi bases there, and a lot of awesome stuff about Hitler and potential scenarios post-World War II with Hitler. Just covers tons of stuff. I really enjoyed the book. Thank you very much, Jerry, for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
That does it for this week's edition of Banal of America Audio. I want to thank Jerry E. Smith for sitting down and talking to us for so long. Really appreciate it. Gave us tons of information. I want to thank Leslie Chiron and R. Lee of BanalofAmerica.com for your help and support with the audio series. And, of course, I want to thank all you great listeners out there who have discovered Banal of America Audio, who have been checking out the interviews. I hope you enjoy what you hear, and I hope you come back for more. Check out BanalofAmerica.com for more esoteric ramblings of the finest sort. We've got columns from Leslie, Chiron, and R. Lee, weekly columns from me, feature articles. If you're a longtime listener of Banal of America Audio and you want to help out, we have a PayPal button at banalofamerica.com. Click the PayPal button. Throw some change in the bucket. Give us a donation. It'll help offset the costs of the audio series. Next week, the guest to be announced. I have somebody lined up for the end of the week, but it's not 100%. We don't have it taped yet, so I don't want to announce anybody for sure. But it looks like we should have a show. If not, we will take the week off, but check back at banalofamerica.com on Friday or Saturday to find out more, and you'll know then if we will have a guest or not, or if we'll have a show or not. We should have a more definitive schedule coming out soon for the rest of the season. We expect to wrap up Banal of America Audio Season 1 towards the end of May, so we've got about 2.5 months left of esoteric audio at its finest. Then we'll be taking some time off to roll out Season 2, but that's a long way off. For now, I'm Tim Banal, signing off.